All right. Well, it looks like I have the dubious distinction of going last. So, my name is Robert Walls, and today I have the pleasure of presenting our work on effective digital forensics. This was done in collaboration with my advisor, Brian Levine and Mark Liberatore at the University of Massachusetts and Clay Shields at Georgetown University. I want to mention up front that this isn't a technical talk. The content is based on a position paper, and this talk is structured much like a call to action. So I want to start with a brief survey. How many of you have seen the TV show CSI or one of its many, and I do mean many, spinoffs? Well, I see some hands and some nods, but for those of you who don't know, CSI is a hit TV...
Even those of us who haven't seen it know.
Yes, everybody knows. Good point. So CSI stands for Crime Scene Investigation, and over the course of an hour, very attractive forensic examiners use their intelligence and their wits to solve complex crimes and cases. Well, I probably don't need to tell you this, but real forensics and real forensic investigators aren't like what you see on TV, and perhaps worst of all, they don't look like you see on TV. So, this disparity is especially pronounced for digital forensics. Real digital forensic investigations are much more bland. In fact, typical analysis for a desktop machine typically involves a guy sitting in a cubicle staring at a computer screen for long hours. Much like graduate school, I find. So, CSI and all the other shows that sensationalize the abilities of digital forensics and forensic science have actually had a surprising effect on real life. In fact, they have dramatically raised the expectations of juries in criminal cases. This so-called CSI effect means that prosecutors are burdened with trying to provide more and more forensic evidence, and that these juries expect the forensic evidence to be as sensational and advanced as you see on TV. Of course, we think that security also suffers a bit from the CSI effect, albeit in a slightly different manner. One of the motivations for our paper is based on my co-author's experiences on program committees for security conferences. They found that regularly good forensics research was being underestimated, and that they were also often overestimating the applicability of other work to forensics. So, in addition to the general population's view of digital forensics, forensics also suffers from a more fundamental problem. Put simply, digital forensics lacks a solid scientific foundation. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences recently published a scathing report calling for a complete overhaul of digital forensics. And even if we put aside this fundamental question of science, digital forensics is still struggling to meet practical challenges. Prevalent forensic techniques do not scale, and already the demand is much greater than current capacity. You know, it's easy to see when you consider that a single suspect could have multiple desktop computers, they could have a laptop, maybe multiple cell phones. And then when you add devices like digital cameras and Xboxes, all these things need to be examined, and it could easily take weeks or even months to do so. So it's no surprise that forensic labs have a significant backlog of cases to process. And, you know, the situation is even scarier when you consider the high cost of getting it wrong. Basically, bad forensic techniques and practices can lead to the bad guys getting away and the good guys getting locked up. So here's my call to action. I think that security researchers are in a very unique position to contribute to digital forensics. This is in part because of your technical expertise and your willingness to push traditional system boundaries. Now, there is quite a bit of overlap between security and forensics, but I want to stress that forensics is not security. Just as privacy is strongly coupled with security but traditionally considered separate, forensics has its own unique set of goals and constraints. And over our group's many years of working directly with law enforcement, we've made a number of observations that we think will help those of you thinking of making a foray into forensics. We've compiled these observations to identify a set of 5 basic principles for forensics research. While this talk isn't about identifying what the big research questions in forensics are, instead our goal is to enumerate these principles so that you can use them when thinking about forensics or when trying to evaluate forensics research. So much of our work and these principles are based primarily on the US civil and criminal context, but they largely apply to other contexts as well. Of course, I do have to give a bit of a disclaimer. Our goal is to help law enforcement catch criminals. It's not our desire or our intention to help Big Brother spy on citizens. The NSA and other three-letter agencies operate under a completely different set of restrictions, and frankly, they're not law enforcement. And what they do is not forensics, it's more akin to intelligence gathering. Well, with that disclaimer out of the way, let's go over the first principle. Principle number one, digital forensics is investigator-centric. If you only take one thing away from this presentation, I want it to be this, that digital forensics is investigator-centric. So by investigator-centric, I mean that the research should be driven by the investigator, that the research must take into account the specific goals and constraints of its target investigator. And this is analogous to what you see in security research with specific attacker models. So to motivate this principle, let's use the criminal investigator as an example. For the criminal investigator, the law provides the set of constraints they must follow. If the criminal investigator violates these constraints, they risk having all their evidence become inadmissible in a court of law. In other words, if they break the rules, the judge might throw out all the ill-gotten evidence. However, one of the things that makes forensics so interesting to do work in is that these laws are always changing, that the law is always in flux. And in fact, a single court decision or a single piece of legislation could have a major impact on how investigators must operate. And this leads us to our second principle, that forensics and the law are inseparable. You cannot divorce forensics from the law. Unfortunately, the law is struggling to keep up with the pace of technology. For investigators, this means it's not clear how the law applies to new technologies, even for long-standing and traditional legal constructs such as the Fourth Amendment. For those of you who may not be aware, the Fourth Amendment protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizure by the government. But how does seizure apply to data? So imagine the following scenario. Police seize a suspect's hard drive. Now, they have seized that hard drive. They've seized the physical device. Now, imagine sometime later, they return the drive, but not before they've made a byte-by-byte copy of the drive's contents. Now, of course, they've no longer seized the drive, but have they seized the drive's data? So as security researchers, your first reaction is probably, yes, they've seized that drive's data. But really, the courts haven't quite decided this question yet, and current opinions are mixed. So this means that investigators are often unwilling or too timid to try techniques that haven't been vetted in a court of law yet. Understandably, they don't want to lose a case because they can't prove to a jury that the technique and the resulting evidence is valid. Of course, we can help assuage those fears by basing that technique in sound scientific principles. Principle number three, investigations are about people. It's easy for us to focus entirely on the machine or the system because as computer scientists, that's what we know best. However, it's the person and not the machine that's under investigation. This means that investigators often focus on things that are outside of the scope of the traditional security domain. For example, user intent is relevant to most crimes. Now, an investigator will often demonstrate that intent by showing a series of actions that the suspect took on the target machine. And when you consider hacking crimes, such actions often violate some security policy of the machine, of some machine. However, just because a computer was used to commit a crime doesn't mean that any security policy on that computer is violated. For example, imagine that a user uses their own computer to download child pornography off a peer-to-peer network. Now, that's illegal, but no security policy is violated when they download that. So this means that systems that answer questions about user behavior are still useful even if no specific security problem is being addressed, and that researchers must be aware of the focus on people and not just on computers. Principle number four, it's still useful to catch the dumb ones. By that, I mean forensics research still has value, even if it helps with a common adversary, even if it can't catch the most sophisticated criminals. In fact, many forensic techniques are easily thwarted with just a small change by the attacker. For example, going back to the child pornography example, law enforcement typically uses hash values of files to find images of child pornography on peer-to-peer networks. And of course, the suspect could easily just flip a single bit to change the hash value and thus avoid detection. But law enforcement have observed that millions do not, in fact. And there are many reasons for this. And first, they may not think they need to, or they could potentially lack the technical skill. Second, they may not think they're going to be caught, and percentage-wise, that's largely true. And third, especially in the case with child pornography, such sharing, they want to share the content. And they'll even give the content very, very descriptive file names, including, and I'm not kidding here, they'll give a file the name illegal child pornography. And, you know, in that case, there's no legal reason for them to even bother flipping a bit. So, obviously, law enforcement wants to catch the most dangerous criminals to society. However, there's no known correlation between dangerousness to society and tech savvy. That is, tech savvy criminals aren't necessarily more dangerous. Okay. And oddly enough, you know, when it comes to security, if you have a system that only stops 40% of the people from getting in, you know, that's considered a loss. That's considered pretty useless. But in forensics, if you have a system that only catches 40% of the bad guys, that's still considered good. It's still considered useful. And finally, we come to principle number 5, keep it simple. By keep it simple, I don't mean dumb down your research or do simple work. I mean make it simple for the investigator to reap the benefit of your research. You know, when you're doing forensics research, ostensibly the goal is to have impact on the community. And one way to do this is to create a tool or a technique that can be used by law enforcement. However, if that technique requires capabilities that are outside of the reach of law enforcement, then they can't use it. And this actually ties in closely with principle number 2, that forensics and the law are inseparable. And their capabilities, the capabilities of the investigator, are determined by the law. For example, imagine we have a suspect who's using Skype, an encrypted voice communication, to talk about some crime or crime that they're going to commit. Now, of course, we could always try and use a technique, and law enforcement could try and use a sophisticated technique for inferring information directly from the encrypted voice stream. And recently, there was a paper published at Oakland that did some really cool stuff with phonetics and encrypted voice streams. Unfortunately, such techniques can't be used. U.S. law requires that investigators first get a warrant before they intercept any digital communications, which means that if they want to use these Skype techniques, they have to first get a warrant. Now, if they can just get a warrant for that, then they can probably get a warrant to covertly install a microphone inside the suspect's residence and other monitoring equipment. A microphone is likely more reliable and easier for law enforcement to implement, and thus it obviates the need for our sophisticated inference techniques. So it's easy for us to forget that sometimes there are simpler solutions to problems that don't actually involve computers. So as I said, all right. What about research, forensics research, that doesn't use these principles? Well, put simply, forensics research without these principles is not forensics. It might be better described as intelligence gathering or data recovery, but it's not forensics. Of course, such research is still useful, and it may be useful to a lot of people, but it's not useful for the people who need it most, law enforcement. You know, I hope these principles that we've given actually help some of you in the audience. Some of them seemed a bit silly, maybe others a bit obvious, but I hope that at least some of you have gained something from this talk, because I know that forensics research has a lot to gain from security researchers. And that brings us to the end of this talk. Thank you.